Thank you very much for all these kind words. And the UK is a very, very friendly society. I knew that, of course, but now I also experience it. So it is great to be here, actually, in that respect. What I would like to do with you today is I would like to defend this thesis. And we can decide at the end of this whether we subscribe to this or not, but one measure is enough. So we should not be using more than one measure. So that's the theme for now. And what I would like to specifically discuss with you is how I can associate the use of measures to motivate people. How can I motivate people with using these measures? And why then motivation is best served with using one measure only. I just want to get my timeline here correct. So this is what I want to discuss. So, but before that, I want to show you a little video on how you can motivate people. Okay, this is one way of motivating people. just that you know. Of course, this was Jordan Belfort. That's the guy he plays. And he's still active now in actually giving talks about also motivation. But he also had to spend some time in jail because it was a little bit over the top what he did in terms of his work. This is one way of motivating people. Well, we are in performance management, and we tend to measure performance. And the question is why? We think that we motivate people with that if we use performance measures. We think that if we tell them how well they are performing, that is helpful to them as well. It's more encompassing. In addition, it's important that we realize that people think and find it important that they do meaningful work. And what is then meaningful work? And you've been distributed a little sheet with a matrix on it, that is this matrix. And I saw that some people already solved, or tried to solve at least, the matrix. And so I give you, just 1 minute to look at it, and then I will cold call someone. How about that? Just 1 minute. Have a look at it. Solve it. And fold it. And not sort it. All right. So people solve. I'm going to fold it. Can I have your But I would like to show that is not necessarily the case. So this exercise was done with more than one matrix, and it was done by Dan Ariely and his colleagues. And he actually introduced three conditions to solve these matrices. One was that indeed it was destroyed, like I just did. The other was neglect. So after completion, the sheet was handed in and put on a stack. And the three was acknowledged. And then the question is, when did the participants work hardest? And of course, they worked harder when their work was recognized, at least that the name was on the sheet and that the researcher actually looked at the results and then put the sheet on a file. They also did this. This is another test that they did. They looked at the sheet where the participants had to find two S's. I underlined them here. That was not the case in the. I don't know whether. No, well. So I underlined them here. That was not the case in the original experiment. So they had to find. They had to find two S's, and they get 55 cents. If they did one sheet, 1.5 when they did two sheets, etc. So a declining number in terms of money. So what motivates better? Destroy, neglect, acknowledge. What they find is that in the acknowledge stage, it's more likely that they work harder. So they get more money, but they also are more likely to keep working. So it helps if not only you give money, but also show that what they do is important to you as an observer. Of course, it might also be an important task to you yourself, doing the task, that you yourself think that is an important task. Another question that they ask is, you know, when do people stop working? And what they actually find is that if you acknowledge their contribution, that it takes them longer to stop working. So here they stop when they still get 28 cents, here they stop only when they still get 14 cents. So it takes them longer to stop working, solving these matrices. Makes you ask yourself, you know, why would you go into work every day? Why do you go into work? You go into work because you like your work, but why do you like your work? Well, we are a social being, and you go into work because you like to do that work, but also because others in that organization like what you do in your firm or in your organization. That is important as well to you. And of course, we also tie income, dependent on how well we perform. And sometimes we get people credit, that's why we have a fixed salary. And sometimes we do not, that's why we give variable salary. So considerations in terms of what motivates you is questions like, is this work that is important to you? Working for a charity, for instance, can be very important to you, and you don't need any money to actually perform that kind of work. What is important to your peers? Do other people really appreciate the work that you do? Do they tap you on the shoulder? It doesn't have to be a BMW that you get. It can also be a tap on the shoulder. And how do these others communicate, indeed, that they care about what you do? So these are all things that are going to affect your motivation. Now the measurement. We measure performance. And this measurement tells something about how well the work that people do is actually, in the end of the day, appreciated or not. We have the balanced scorecard. And I remember discussions here in London at the time that where the balanced scorecard was heavily criticized. But you know, the fact of the matter is that it is used throughout the world. The balanced scorecard in some disguise has many measures. How many measures are useful? Do we need fewer measures? And if we should be using fewer measures, how many should that be? And I would like to take you to one example of Continental Airlines. I was actually pointed by Rick that I could also have taken the example of British Airways. I'm sorry for that. This is a written case that I know quite well. So let's look at Continental Airlines and what they did. So Continental Airlines, at some stage in the 90s, started using one measure for the rank and file personnel, ground personnel, cabin crew, and the like. They had some problems, and the problem was that they were on the list in terms of on-time arrival and luggage delivery all the time. This is domestic flights, by the way. They also had one number one position, but you know, not necessarily what we want, is that it was the number of complaints, right? So that's not necessarily where you want to be. So in 1994, total losses accrued to 613 million, and actually the Continental Airlines at the time was ready for bankruptcy. That's where they were. In 1995, they appointed two new leaders, Gordon Batoon and Greg Brenneman, and Continental started to introduce a new group incentive. And that incentive was attached, tied to one performance measure only, and that was on-time departure. On-time departure of planes. 35,000 non-managerial employees could receive a cash bonus, and that cash bonus was conditioned on ending up in the top five for on-time departure. They had to end up nationally in the US in the top five. And if they would end up in the top five, they would get $65. Whether they were in Los Angeles, whether they were at O'Hare in Chicago, didn't matter. Everyone got the $65 at the time. Good idea, eh? Good idea? Okay. Well, you know, I'm an economist. I think it's a very bad idea. It's an extremely bad idea. And why is it a bad idea? Because it introduces a massive free rider problem. People at LAX will be LAX and will relax and will not work very hard, while people in O'Hare might be working hard, but it's not very helpful, but in LAX, because in Los Angeles they are not working very hard, so we will never end up in the top five. But the program worked. The program magically worked. And the employees worked harder and were way more goal-oriented than they were ever were. And the question then is, why? Why was that the case? Well, there's actually quite some reasons why this worked. And it has to do with the way that the performance measure, of course, was used in the firm. But it was more than that. It was more than that. The right measure. Since the performance is measured not by Continental Airlines, but by a central authority, there was no way that anyone could manipulate that measure. No way. So it was a fair comparison with the performance of competitors was possible without any manipulation. Second, the measure is sensitive to the effort of the crew members and the ground staff. You could actually measure in Los Angeles, particularly, whether they did their best. You could actually measure in O'Hare whether or not they did their best. Right? So you could actually drill it down. And they, at that level, had say over, you know, what whether or not whether the plane could depart in time. Also, the measure is concrete, because it pertains to a topic that is critical to everyone in the organization. Everyone. Question could be, but the measure contains a lot of noise. Well, if you can drill it down to the specific airports, you can actually decrease that as well. I am Dutch from origin, and if there's one thing that we hate as a full population is that other people look at what I'm doing. I just hate that, and that's our that's a Dutch cultural thing. To an extent, it's also true, I found out already here in the UK. People don't like to be watched. So checking up on each other is not necessarily what everyone likes, but here it works. Why does it work? The working groups are relatively small. And these small groups, right, they are more tolerant to each other if they are giving advice to each other. And the activities that they do are very closely related to each other. So that's the second reason why this worked. Then there were also visible rewards, where actually the boss came up to the employee to say, you've done very well. Thank you for that. And he or she would be handed this envelope of $65. Tax was already deducted, so they could start spending it immediately. Feels like a windfall. Of course, the force was also the momentum. And the momentum was created in very many ways. One was that the task was engineered in a way that it was possible to achieve this target of on-time departure, to end up in the top five, right? So they had given new thoughts as to how to organize all this. So the flight schedules, you know, they got better slots and the like. It's also the case that everyone got a bonus, which gave people the feeling that they were in it together. And of course, lastly, you know, this firm was almost going bankrupt. And here was a possibility that if we would do our best, we could actually save maybe the firm. It's also an important factor in this regard. So what they did is, as managers, is that they made sure that people they cared about, that everyone knew that what they were doing was actually very meaningful to them and to the firm. And they made the work important to each individual employee. They didn't mind that much that their performance was observed, and they liked it, of course, that they were rewarded. So you get to see what you achieve is important. I think that's also an important factor of the balanced scorecard, indeed, containing many measures, but what is important is that you can see what is your achievement. Here we have one measure where we can see what is our joint achievement. Your boss gets to see what you achieve. And actually, your boss does reward you if you meet the expectations. So here, you yourself can see what is the achievement. The boss observes your achievement and rewards your achievement. So important to you, the work is important to you, and your boss also refers to it, how important it is that work is being done. So that's just giving meaning, right? Not ripping apart someone's performance, but actually appreciating someone's performance and also show how that performance actually helps the firm forward. Well, at the end of 1996, the bankruptcy was no longer an issue. And of course, they increased the incentives, and actually they also ratcheted up the performance, so they had to end up in the top three. So no longer top five was good enough. Typically, accountants, why they keep ratcheting up this target. And further improvements in effort and cooperation were actually observed. Number of sick days kept going down. And of course, in 2010, Continental merged with United Airlines. And they are still together. Under the name Continental United Airlines. So this is a firm that only uses one measure of performance. Only one. Of course, you know, there were also all kinds of safety measures that were taken, that people were not going to, like the groups, were not going to put the firm at risk by cutting corners in the work that they did to make sure that the plane would depart in time, because that's what you have to think about also. All these measures were engineered within Continental Airlines. So why would it be conducive if we only have a few measures? So now I'm going to actually try to defend my thesis, really. And I'm very curious about how you subscribe to that thesis today. In the first place, when we are using many measures, overconfidence, everyone is overconfident. Men more than women, but everyone is to an extent overconfident. And last time I was telling someone also, you are a woman, I said, well, you are overconfident, and she said, no, I'm not overconfident. And then I showed her that she was also overconfident. Everyone is to an extent overconfident. One observation is that if we think that we have lots of information, that is actually going to enhance our processing capacity. And actually we know since Miller 1956, and we'll come back to that later again, and that is repeated in many studies, that is not the case. If we have more measures of performance, that is not necessarily actually going to enhance our processing capacity. Slovich did that research in 1986, handicapped that had to predict which horse would win. And the handicappers were allowed to use the following past performance charts, the ones that they used to predict the performance of these. So they could use 5, 10, 20, 40. And then the question is, what is the result? Are they better when they have 40 observations, charts, or are they better if they have 20 and 10? Turns out that handicapper thinks to know better when he has access to more information points, to more items. But that is not the case. And the same would hold true, I would say, for supervisors who believe that they know better with more measures, which is also unlikely to be the case. This is the result of Slovich. So what you see in the top line, black line, with the yellow deltas, is how confident they are that they will be correct in their prediction. The pink line actually shows that they become less accurate when they are using more performance measures to make that assessment, right? So it's highly questionable whether, if we are going to use many measures, that is actually helpful in making sure that people make better decisions, right? And if they find out at some point that the decisions that they make are not that correct, while they assume that they are correct, right? That's a little bit strange. But still what we see is that if we extend the number of performance measures, that they think that they are better. So they might be working harder to get there, because they are motivated, you know, also in terms of meaning, right? But they are quite unlikely to get a reward because they actually performance may deteriorate, which is not what we want, right? So on the one hand, they might be working harder, then they do not get a reward, and if that happens time after time, they get a little bit disgruntled. So from that point of view, it might not be the best idea to use many measures. Now it's a tongue breaker for me, paternalism. I've practiced on that. The pronunciation in Dutch is completely different, paternalism. So that's the second problem that potentially is attached to this idea of using many measures. Let's look at this. Let's look at a situation where we are just using residual income. Sales minus costs gives us profit. Profit minus cost of capital times assets gives us residual income. So here we can be assessing a business unit manager or a divisional manager just on residual income. He or she can decide how he or she will get there. Increase sales if the economy is booming, cut the costs if the economy is not doing that well. That's what they can decide. Renegotiate, cost of capital. Cut down assets. We can also use all these other profit, sales, cost, lead time of order processing, the number of new products that we need to use, a further number of new products customer satisfaction, cooperation, how well do they cooperate, how well do they coordinate their activities, etc. Sorry. Etc. So we can use many measures. And we can use all these measures individually. And set targets for profit, for cost, for sales, lead time, customer satisfaction, image. We can set targets for all these measures. What am I doing? What will, on average, a divisional manager at, let's say, a district manager at Unilever, what will be his or her income? Any idea? What will be the income of such a manager? Okay. So a manager like in Unilever, like district manager, what will be his or her income?
$78,000.
Okay. So now we are looking at someone who is paid, you know, not a bad salary. And we are going to tell exactly that what he or she has to do on these 12 measures. So the boss is saying, I know exactly what you have to do to improve. He has to do all these things. If you do that, great. It feels like I know nothing. I'm stupid, right? I know nothing. My boss knows everything. Knows exactly what the target should be for profit. Knows exactly, you know, where I should labor priorities. Is it in costs or in sales? I don't know anything. I just have to. Well, you know, people with a master in accounting background will not be very happy to do such a job. Right? So this is really going to eat into your motivation to do this job. That's what I mean with commitment. Your boss is telling you what to do. Not letting you free, like the Brazilian income, to choose what is the best priority. That's what I mean with commitment. And yeah, that is going to affect motivation. This is a research study that I'm doing right now. Well, the study is done, but the paper, as you all know, sometimes it's quicker. But okay, so this is a new paper where we look into a construction firm. And in that construction firm, they decide that the working capital is way too high. No, the working capital is way too high. That has to go lower. And they call on their project managers, who make like 80,000 euros. They called up on their project managers, you have to reduce working capital. And this is the target that we set. There's no way that you can do otherwise, you have to do that. What we observe is that the junior project managers, they are all right with that introduction. They don't mind that. We see indeed that the working capital goes down for them. That is not what we see for the senior managers. The senior managers, they are particularly disgruntled. And why are they disgruntled? They have to negotiate. They have to negotiate with their clients all the time. And how much the client is, you know, how much he still owes us as a firm, right, is part of the negotiation. Right? Not the invoice, right? The burning rate is an important issue. Right? But that's only one thing, because the project manager can come up with a proposal saying, well, I'm going to use a little material of a little bit different specification, because I can cut a little bit on the cost end. Are you going to do it? Of course. But not if you do this. Right? If you're going to cut down by making pay earlier, I'm not going to do it. And that's why these seniors are more likely to be in like an equilibrium, which is not achieved, not yet achieved for the juniors. So they were more willing to go along with this new policy. So, potentially, these seniors really thought, you know, you're actually now really going against my relationship with the client, and I don't want you to do that. So, yes, it's going to impact the motivation, the paternalism, it's going to impact
motivation that you have to work is going to impact on the meaning of work. Your meaning is that you come up with the best solution to the firm, to the construction firm, right? Where you find some equilibrium between cutting your costs on one hand, and sometimes you have to let go a little bit, like with work again. You have to do that. You have to accept that. Right? So these patellas are going to eat in on the likelihood they actually are going to achieve the job. So many measures, they're using many measures and prescribing what to do, that's actually an insult to a high paid employee. Third reason why I think that it might not be a good idea to use many measures. The third thing is that you start to create actually a market for excuses. Again, we look at all these measures, right? Let's say that you are a manager. There's always a couple of measures that you will achieve. Actually, we had that in the Netherlands with a utility firm. They had this. So the top managers of that utility firm, right, they had like 11 measures, and I looked it up in their annual report. And so I wrote actually an editorial on that in the Dutch Financial Times. They always hit once, I said. Right. Oh, they always hit a few measures, so it's very easy for them actually to get a bonus. Too easy. And of course, the chairman of the board of directors, he was furious on me because, you know nothing. That's what he said, you know nothing. And so he wrote that he wrote a letter to the Dutch Financial Times to say that. So I wrote him a letter and, but he was not convinced. I was totally wrong. 2 years later, they only had 3 measures. Because, it was the case that the targets were also set that easily that they could always hit someone, something. But it can also go, that can actually go in a way where you say, well, the performance measures that I hit, and that's all because of me, of course. The performance measures that I didn't hit is because of you, because you said, too high time. Right? But it's politics. So you just ask for that. If you are using the more measures that you use, right, the more likely it becomes that you set the wrong measures for any of those, right? And we'll see that later on a little bit more. And the more likely it is that politics comes in. Resilience is very simple. More than zero. So again, impact on the meaning that you attach to the work that you have to do, because sometimes sales is important, otherwise cost is important, and other times customer satisfaction becomes important. Hey, what am I supposed to do in this work, right? And what gets rewarded? More than you decide yourself what gets rewarded, you look at the measures that at the easy start, and that's where you're going to focus. Fourth reason why it may not be a good idea to use many measures. How am I doing with the time? Is it, I have still 11:30, right? Okay. Information processing capacity. We know since 1956, that actually has looked at how many measures can people at the same time keep in their head. And it happens to be the case that the title of that paper is the magic 5 or 7. Then as soon as it is more than 5, right, then it becomes difficult to actually use it. So if you are looking at 12 measures, it's very likely to become very difficult for you to keep in mind sources that you have to keep in the air, rolling, right? So 5 to 7 is the absolute maximum. And that is not only demonstrated by Wilmer in 1956, it has been in 2004 again by Sylvia of Focus in Nature. So this is not just, you know, something that was discovered then, but it was actually it's reconfirmed again in 2004.
Again, this is going to impact on where to set priorities. Where should I set priorities? What is, in the end, important to my boss? And then you have to make a guess on what is the most important of these 12 measures, because you know that your boss is also not able to look at more than 5 measures. So then it's likely that the 5 that you think of are different than the 5 that your boss thinks of. So your boss might be rewarding different measures than you had in mind. Fifth reason why I think that we might consider to reduce the number of measures that we are using has to do with assigning appropriate weights. I go back to Baker,
2002. Let's think of union. And we are thinking of a production manager at Port Sunlight, and that production manager has to think of the production costs that he is making. We could also assign a high weight to the share price of Unilever to assess the performance of that same production manager at Port Sunlight. Is that wise? Well, this particular manager might not feel so much, but I don't feel that he has so much influence on the share price of Unilever. I mean, if they make decisions his production manager does not particularly have much influence on it. So the likelihood that he or she will alienate from that decision is quite high.
On the other hand, if we only look at the production costs, that might also not be the wise thing.
Because if clients from their products are customized, right, production costs might increase, and that production manager, his or her function is just set based on production costs, right? We'll then see that okay, production costs are not going to help the customer. So it's better actually to make and that's important concept to make a profit conscious budget, right? In this case. So that's something that we want to think of. So we want to think about what does it do, the decisions of this particular manager to newly report at Port Sunlight, not just cost, but also the profit. So we have to think about to what extent does a measure alienate the individual manager, and to what extent does using a very disaggregate performance measure increase the likelihood that he or she will start to destroy rather than to create it. Well, and then we have a choice. Now we have a choice. Let's say that we have two measures in store. One is a firm by Unilever measure, and the other is a cost measure, the cost of that department. And
for the ease of thinking, assume that it costs
as much to you to improve firm by profit in one unit and cost of the department. If we then want to motivate a measure and have to weigh the performance, we have no choice than to put 50% weight on each of these measures. That's the only thing that we can do, because then I'm sure that I'm going to improve with one unit if the firm by profit and the cost. But you know, then we also have to think at the same time, is it the case that if we improve firm by profit with one unit and cost of the department with one unit, that at the same time, same percentage hold for value creation and get part. Not or net. Which has to do with the fact that it's very unlikely if we are looking at different measures and improvement in these particular measures, that if we improve in these measures, that then also at the same rate value will be created. Right? And that's what we observe in here. So in just in case, should we go back to 70-30% in putting weights, putting measures? Is that a good idea? Same assumption for motivation, the weight should be 1/3, 1/3, 1/3. 4 measures, 1/4, 1/4, 1/4, 1/4. And it becomes highly unlikely that that is still associated at the same rate with value creation. So the more measures that I use, the more difficult it becomes actually to maintain the association between value and motivation. Well, this is the same thing. I mean, it's about attention, profit, or the ratio of old new. Same idea. And you know, as soon as I start increasing the number of measures, not going to work. Not going to work. So here again, when I'm looking at weights, I have to think about how many measures. And again, it's true that the least measures I have, the more likely it is that the weights that I put on these measures are still as close as possible to value creation. So, what do we have? There's a price to having many measures in the system. And these prices are given by the fact that it makes people feel that they know more than they really do. That's the overconfidence. And again, we have to specifically look at men because they become even more overconfident than women. Second is that it is paternalistic actually to use many measures because I'm exactly prescribing what to do. I'm prescribing to someone who has maybe paid 80,000, 100,000 pounds and tell him or her what to do. Spoon feeding, right? Well, these people are a little bit too expensive and also too knowledgeable to do that, right? That's a waste. I'm also creating a market for excuses. The market for excuses, with which I mean politics comes in. Everything that I do achieve of the 12 measures is because of me, and everything that I do not achieve is because of you. Can't help it, right? Not my fault. Your target was ridiculous. Your target was ridiculous. I cannot achieve that. Fourth reason is to do with information processing capacity. How much information can someone actually process? Again, we know since Miller, 5 to 7 measures maybe. We can keep them in their head at the same time, but then it's over. So if we think of a balanced scorecard of 25 measures, no one can actually do that. And we have to decide on what are the appropriate weights. What are the appropriate weights that we can put on each measure? This is all going to really impact on the likelihood of value destruction. So if we are using many measures, we think that we are doing the correct thing. Actually, we are doing the wrong thing. One measure is enough. Better use one measure. Our residual income, as such, is better than combining profit and cost as two measures, right? So just use residual income and let the manager decide where he or she is going to lay his or her emphasis. Of course, we have to accept at some level of value destruction. We know that because we want to motivate people, and it's not that easy to exactly work out what is the best way to do that. But we have to think about this. If we are using measures and disaggregate at a very low level, we also have to think of what decision rights are we going to give. Like in the example with
Continental Airlines, right? Continental Airlines made sure that people could not cut corners, could not decide, for instance, also we're going to extend the teams, right? So you have to decrease then the decision rights to make sure that the things happen that you want to happen. So what motivates people? Well, you have to do work that is meaningful. Meaningful to you and meaningful to others in the organization or outside the organization. And these people, these others, have to show that what you do is important. And that can be money, but it can also be a tap on the shoulder. Any appreciation. And when it comes to giving responsibilities, in many cases, it's better to give responsibilities than to strip responsibilities. El asked, you know, maybe Jan can tell about a study that he did in Tel Aviv. That's a study actually on banks, and it looks at the regulator, and the regulator decided that the SMEs, the small businesses, that they got their loans too easy. So what we've looked at there is at a situation where the loan officers were stripped of their responsibilities in making that call, and that was brought to a higher level, and we study, you know, how that impacts. And this is the first time that I saw that actually if you strip responsibilities, that people are willing to accept that. And that is because that bank could tell these loan officers, look, if we look at our provisions, they are way too low compared. They have been way too low compared to actually the risk that you had been reporting to us. And now the regulator saw that as well, so we have to change this, and they accepted that. And actually, in this case, this is the only case that I saw until now where stripping responsibility did work because they accepted it for a reason. So you have to fine-tune difficulty with talent. That's exactly the point. So with that, I would like to thank you very much for listening, and I hope that you actually at least get some food for thought on is it a good idea to have many measures versus reduce the number of measures, and optimally, I think 2-1. Thank you for that.
Questions.
Sure.
There's an aerobic mic. If you put your hand up, and if you're going to ask a question, can you just preface that with your name and who you are?
Wim van der Steed, head of Department of Accounting here at the LSC. I found that you made a curious statement that the measure in Continental was non-manipulatable,
yep.
Cannot be manipulated.
Yep.
And it's because it was a regulated measure, and it was probably measured by some industry regulator. So it was not manipulable in terms of someone changing a number from 1 to 2. But it was still manipulable in the sense that people could make decisions and engage in behaviors to improve the value of the measure without actually enhancing customer satisfaction or on-time delivery.
Right.
So, for example, maybe they decided to depart on time knowing that only half of the luggage is on the plane. But we measure on-time departure, so we better get out of here.
I find that...
Now to conclude my thesis is, oh yeah, no, but our people won't do this. Okay, I don't think it's going to go very far. How do we know they're not going to do this? Oh, let's measure something else. Oh, what are we going to measure? Oh, well, whatever it is, customer satisfaction. Because surely such a decision would lead to declining customer satisfaction even though you have increased on-time departure.
Yep.
And so now you get into the sort of mill of, because of Campbell's law, it's not manipulable just in the fact of that you can change the number, but it's manipulable in the types of decisions that you make because it is measured but not always triggering the decisions that are intended. And so I agree with you that there is a price to multiple measures, but there is also a price to just one measure, and one of it is incompleteness. And incompleteness oftentimes drives organizations to want to measure more than one thing.
Yeah.
And surely there is a point where you are going too far with that.
Of course.
And so I think that's the trade-off that I wanted to get your reaction to.
Thank you very much for that insightful question. One thing that they also did is they reduced the decision rights. So they could not decide that only half the luggage would go with that plane. They could not make that decision. So next to this output measure, right, they had procedures that very well described, you know, what would be a job and what would be a bad job. So they really reduced the decision rights that these particular managers had in that. Of that employee, sorry. Yeah.
Yes. Set of decision rights.
Yep.
Because if you are a well-educated, well-trained, entrepreneurial individual, I don't think you would take well to a reduced set of decision rights.
That's exactly right.
There's a little trade-off to make there. I'm not disputing the essence of the point, but I'm trying to put it in there.
And your point is well taken. No, it's, yeah.
Okay, thank you. We have a question.
George Gross from CDI Paris. I think your case, the example of Continental, was very, very interesting. What was the background of Gordon Beltune and Greg Brenneman before they came? How did they pick up this idea of just having one?
Yeah.
And the second question related to it, how did the people in the company believe in the measurement? Was there some independent organization outside the company, or was it just the accounting department that produced the measure?
Yeah, I don't have the direct answer to your first question. You catch me there. But about the acceptance, I did read in detail in the case. So the way that they made people, or they convinced people that that was possible, is they made sure that the way that the work was organized, that changed compared to the old situation. So that they could, that the people, the employees, could actually, if they would work hard, could actually achieve this on-time departure. So that's what I worked really hard on. So actually redesigning, re-engineering the jobs to the extent that they could reach it. So it was not just, you know, that one measure that they introduced. No. The important part is actually thinking about how should this job really look like. And how can, indeed, if I can make people achieve that target, they also can actually feel how important it is for them to achieve that target. Yeah. There's one more there.
Oh, okay. Hi, Rick Payne, ICAEW. Very interesting presentation and useful insights. The move you make from on-time departure, which is a very concrete measure, despite some of the issues we've heard, to residual income, where you can have something like 20 adjustments between profit and residual income. We've heard examples where companies trying to move to a residual income method, nobody understands it. So can we make that jump from on-time departure as being really valuable to residual income as being something you could actually implement?
So, I mean, indeed, people are very creative when it comes to how to calculate actually, in this case, residual income. I see that in many firms, people tend to be a little bit manipulative in that respect. I've also seen firms where there was no discussion on that. That indeed, that it was pre-described, you know, how do we measure this? No discussion about it. And I think that's essential if you want to do that successfully. I've come across a firm also, a semiconductor firm that you know maybe from the Netherlands. They had me, and you know, the CFO tricked me, and it was a joke of him. He allowed me to look into their system where they had relative performance measurements. And it took me like one morning to find out that every 3 months the reference group was changed, right? And they were always doing better than the reference group, right? But you have to, and he was, and, you know, this guy was, the CFO at the time, he was disgruntled with the whole system as well. And he just wanted me to look at it and, you know, discuss with you how can we change that. But you have to agree at some point, you know, how to prevent people from becoming manipulative in that respect.
There was also the understanding problem. So
yeah.
At a senior level, you understand.
That's right.
Managerial level, you
right.
can understand the conflict.
But exactly. So at this stage, right, using this measure of on-time departure, right, is something that all this ground personnel and cabin personnel could understand. They won't accept residual income. But if you do that, you also have to reduce the decision rights of these non-managerial people, because otherwise they're going to spend money while they have no decision rights. They should not have decision rights on money, because the only measure is on-time departure. Yeah. Thank you.
We have time for one more.
Philip Smith. I work with quite a lot of private equity type businesses and for the for-profit, and it seems to me that the sort of overall conclusion of yours, I mean, the clear simple measure that we all work around and is proven in capitalist society is the one for profit measure, because that's the simple one which in private equity is very much used, and it's a way of sort of focusing everybody towards it. So what you seem to be sort of doing, and that's proven, that's what businessmen work on, it's just make the profit, chaps, and everything else matters. It's about sort of wealth creation. So in a way, you're almost giving a sort of intellectual backing for that approach, whereas I think, as reflected in the earlier sort of questions, obviously there's a whole load of damaging issues about just chasing after one measure, forgetting the long term, wrecking the business, and all the problems associated with sort of capitalist society.
I guess what I'm actually trying to convince you of is to use one measure, not necessarily, improve as much as possible, and just maximize profit or something. But the fact that if you are using many measures, that actually you're not using the intellectual capacity of your employees to the extent that you could be using it had you been using one measure, because then this individual can make his or her own trade-off as to what is going to lead to improvements in this particular measure. So I'm not trying to be socialistic or capitalistic or whatsoever. It has to do with the fact, how much do you appreciate that your employee can think for her or himself? I hope.
Okay, all right. So do join
Thank you very much.
Thank you.